afternoon. You're listening to Verum Sports on your Saturday afternoon. Of course you are. And we are very lucky now to be joined on the line by a St. Albans resident, but a man who is synonymous with success in the world of boxing. He's Ireland's most successful professional boxer all time, the Celtic Warrior, Mr. Steve Collins. Welcome to Verum Sports, Steve. How are you doing?
I'm great, thank you, Andreas. Thanks for the call.
Honestly, well, like I say, it was awesome to discover that you're a St. Albans resident of the mighty city of St. Albans, one of the gems in the sporting crown, particularly when it comes to the world of boxing, Steve. I simply had to have you on Verum Sports. It wouldn't have been right if it wasn't achieved, but there we go. Anyway, Steve, I'm fascinated. I love your career. It's so, so successful. But it kind of took place in almost three stages. Tell me about the, you know, almost the road warrior quality of those first 19 fights out in America?
At a very, very young age, I mean, I'm going with the single digits. When I was like 8, 9 years old, I had a boxing match in my local club. And at that point, I actually fell in love with the sport. And I predicted, I told everybody, this is what I'm going to do. And I'm going to be heavyweight champion of the world. I told everybody, but I obviously didn't grow as big as I thought I would. And I fell in love with the game at a very young age, and my desire was to go on and be a professional. And I did so. I had my success as an amateur international. I won my international fight, so I won the national amateur title. And my last amateur fight, I went to fight in the United States in Yonkers Raceway in New York, and with the Irish team, and everybody else went home, and I decided to stay on, which I planned to do anyway. And I moved then from New York down to Boston, Massachusetts, and I began my professional career in a place called Brockton, Massachusetts, which was the home of the then current middleweight champion of the world, a guy called Marvin Hagler.
Not a bad fighter. He knew his way around the ropes, didn't he?
He was great. He was my favorite fighter at the time, and I planned to go to his gym because I wanted to learn to fight like him. Because I just admired him so much, and that's what was my plan, and that's what I sailed to do, and I done it. I actually had a good job at the time. I worked in the Guinness Brewery in Dublin. I was an electrician there. Things were good, but it was my ambition in life was not to be an electrician. My ambition in life was to be a professional boxer. So, but I always had a belief, you need a trade or a job to fall back on if things don't work out. So there you go. That's how I ended up in the United States.
Hey, lesson to us all there. You have a vision, you commit to it, you roll the dice, and who knows what the future could map out. But goodness me, not a bad amateur career you enjoyed, though. I think 26 Irish titles that you acquired in your time there. Do you have fond memories of those amateur kind of phase of your career?
The amateur career, going back in our day, was a very tough career. There seems to be a lot more fighters around. You seem to be fighting every week, and it was in cold gyms. We didn't have the comforts we have nowadays, because people. I'm going back to the 70s, late 70s and the 80s, when there wasn't so much money around, and there wasn't the government didn't promote and didn't support amateur sports then. So it was tough, but we loved it. But in those days, when I grew up, you either played football or you boxed. And that was it. You didn't have all the other TV channels showing all the other sports. So in my neighbourhood, we used to play football on the road and play for our clubs at the weekend or go to the boxing gym. And I just found that I was a lot more successful in the boxing than I was in the football. And I actually tell people that football started my boxing career because I was no good. So I stuck to the boxing, which I seem to, levitate towards, because I just enjoyed it and it worked for me,
Absolutely. And again, what an amazing career. 39 professional fights, 36 wins, 21 by way of KO, and of course some amazing title nights. But I wonder, Steve, because we talk about all that success, but some of it came a little bit later in your career. There were two WBA middleweight title clashes, belt fights. You lost a points decision to Reggie Johnson, and then another split decision for a Euro middleweight title over in Italy. A lot of people, when they're faced with those blips in their career, take a moment and kind of say, well, let's find a different path. Was that never an option for you? Were you still convinced that you would be a world champion?
I did, because I lost fights which, you know, sometimes can go your way, sometimes don't. Them fights didn't go my way. It wasn't my time. And, you know, losing a decision and getting a beating is a difference. Do you understand? I knew, you know, I didn't perform on the night. I planned it wrong. It wasn't my night. It didn't happen. I wasn't ready. I never lost confidence because, no, I never lost to anybody when I was at my best. If you perform to your best on the night, nothing goes well, and you get beaten by somebody, you then realise I'm not the best. There's better guys out there. But I always knew that on form, I could beat anybody. And my losses came because I didn't hit form, but it wasn't my time. And my time came, you know, some people, you know, develop later in life. I peaked, when I was 30, 31, when most guys are on the way down. I seemed to mature later, and I hit my best in the latter part of my career. And the bigger fights came in the latter part of my career. So it worked out perfect for me because the fights I lost, if I'd have won those fights, I would have been tied up with different promoters.
Yeah.
And I would have had different management control over me, which I wouldn't have been happy with. You know, I'm talking about the Don Kings and that, you know, and the WBC, and I fought with these guys, and these guys promoted me. So I wouldn't have been happy to be under their control. So it worked out to my advantage in the long run because when I did beat Chris Eubank, I became self-managed. I managed my own career and planned my own fights and negotiated my own deals because I was older and more mature. You know, I was confident enough to do that. So it happened to me at the right time. And you know, if I was to write a script, that's exactly how I would have planned it. It went perfect.
You became the master of your own destiny. And very, very few people in the fighting game achieve that. And a massive credit to you. Before we touch upon those epic nights with Chris Eubank up at super middleweight, let's just go back in time for a moment to that first middleweight crown, a fifth round TKO against the very talented Chris Pyatt in 1994. Again, after those blips we've mentioned, that must have felt wonderful, a culmination of all that hard work, all that dice rolling, all that commitment to your craft. What a great night. What are your memories of that victory?
Well, Chris Pyatt was promoted by the same promoter as me, and I was never going to get a chance to fight him. I honestly know, and I was told that he signed me up to stop me getting to Chris Pyatt because he was a bigger draw in the UK than me because I was new to the UK. I was established in America, but not in the UK. But I got that fight because Chris Pyatt left Matchroom Boxing on a certain note, and I was involved in Matchroom Boxing, so rather than let him get away with it and leave them, they then let me fight him so they could bring the title back to Matchroom Boxing. And so it's once again, it's the politics of the whole game. You know, I can sit down and explain to you more. So I got that fight more or less through default, and but at the same time I was considering giving up the middleweight division because I could no longer make the weight for middleweight, and when I fought Chris Pyatt, I don't think he realised how weak I was, and I wasn't able and prepared to go the distance because I just basically starved myself and trained extremely hard to make the weight. I couldn't make the weight anymore, but I made it for that fight. And the two defences I had afterwards to defend the middleweight title, one was in Hong Kong and the other was back in my old hometown of Boston, Massachusetts. Both fights were cancelled, but the last one in Boston, Massachusetts, I actually was so ill and struggled so hard to make the weight that I basically the doctor pulled me out of the fight and told me that I was a sick man, that it was unnatural what I was doing, and under no circumstances was he allowing me to fight, and I became very ill, starving myself to make weight. So I was considering retiring then because I wasn't going to get a chance to fight at super middleweight. Chris Eubank wasn't going to let me fight at super middleweight, and then I, you know, I was home, and I thought, you know, this is it for me. I can't make middleweight anymore. I don't know if I can go through all this again. I'm in my 30s now. And go to the whole super middleweight division to try and get the top to fight for that. So I was going to retire, but then Chris Eubank's opponent, a guy called Raymond Close, failed the medical, and they wanted a last-minute substitute. And my phone rang, and they asked me would I take the fight against Chris Eubank. And I couldn't believe it. It was like a dream come true because not only was it at a heavier weight division that I was, yep, was stronger at, it was a big fight I've been looking for many years, and then when he said to me, this is going to happen on St. Patrick's weekend in the southwest of Ireland, I didn't believe it.
The stars aligned sometimes, Steve. The stars aligned.
It was like a movie, you know. It was all too good to be true, but it happened. We planned a good fight, and it went my way.
It was fabulous. One of my favourite memories in British boxing history. But it was absolutely fascinating as well. Like you say, unexpected, late in the day kind of opportunity, which you seized. At that moment in time, Chris Eubank, massive draw, unbeaten, again, stepping up a weight, and you just schooled him. There's a school of thought, and I'm fascinated. You talk about the politics of boxing, but also the psychology of boxing I find fascinating. And there was lots of talk, wasn't there, about the fact you had a guru and were kind of being hypnotized. That kind of got in to the head of Eubank. I don't want to use that as a blemish. I think you schooled him, like I mentioned. But that element of the boxing game fascinates me. To what extent was that something you planned, or was it just one of those things that came together naturally?
Well, we planned it because, you know, when you look at opponents, you've got to understand the psyche as well as the physical ability, the mental state, so on, because it's a game of both physical and mental, you know, demand boxing. So I looked at Chris Eubanks and realised that he was the master of mind games. And I thought, I've got to take this away from him. So he came in with the hypnotist and the guru, telling Chris Eubank at the weigh-in that I'd be hypnotized and I wouldn't feel pain and I'd fight like a machine and I'd be punching harder and if I got cut I wouldn't bleed. I mean, we hit him with everything and he totally freaked out and he wanted to pull out a fight. So it was the edge on the mind games building up. But when the fight took place, you know, the bell rings, we both obviously fighting instinct and it was the reality then. So he winced and he bitched about the whole mind games and he called me a cheat and so on. I straight away I said, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll give you my first defense.
Absolutely.
So my next fight was, I gave a rematch immediately and there was no mind games then. There's no excuse then. I just beat him fair and square. So finally, put an end to his amazing run.
Well, to be honest with you, just coming back to that rematch, just another element of the skill that you possess, Steve, was that you completely evolved what was the typical MO on a Steve Collins way of fighting and were just, on that night, a force of nature. So, again, to kind of adapt your game to seize moments, they seem to me to be the character traits of the Steve Collins success story.
Well, yeah, I had to fight a different fight. I had to come at him in a way that he wouldn't expect and do something totally different. It wasn't the way I would normally fight. It was very open, very very raw and very... very
brutal. I would use the word brutal that night.
I think it was very sloppy, actually, but it was unexpected from him. And because I trained so hard and was so fit and kept coming at him, I think I totally disoriented him, caught him off guard, and his fight plan, you know, it didn't work because he had a fight plan for a different opponent than what actually happened. So it was just, it's what you have to do in the game. You know, you got to adapt in boxing. And I explain to people that it's not always the best fighter that wins on the night. It's the fighter sometimes with the best plan. And, you know, better fighters than me have not won world title fights because they haven't planned it right. I, you know, planned my fights and tried to, undermine my opponents and do what was positive for me and negative for them by changing styles and that, and it worked for me, you know. So if you're a one-trick pony, people know what to expect, but if you can change your styles and change your fight plans, you can fight them what's coming at them and set them back.
What an era of British boxing that was, though. My goodness me, particularly from that super middleweight division. Also, after the two Eubank victories, again, a name synonymous with that era, Nigel Benn, two victories over Benn too. I got to ask you, it fascinates me. And I guess, as you say, you got to adapt. No two fighters will be the same. No two nights will be the same. But obviously, you fought Benn. You fought Eubank on four occasions. Of those two, who would you say was the superior?
They're both different styles. And both, I put them both at the same level. The difference being, the one that scared me the most was Nigel Benn. Chris Eubank is the toughest guy I ever fought and never shared a ring with him. And he's, you know, I never punched an oak tree, but imagine if you punch an oak tree and there's no effect on it. That's a bit like Chris Eubank, who's very, very tough and very dangerous. And he was always there, he was awkward. But Nigel Benn had the ability to punch. Some guys have this ability to hit and punch, you know, really, really, really hard. And Nigel Benn was one of those guys. And I knew getting into the ring and fighting him that he won't have to look for me. I'm going to be there, and he's going to hit me. And I didn't know how I would react when I get caught by, you know, such a devastating puncher. And you know, Nigel Benn did catch me, and he did hurt me. But he hurt me more than he realised. I think he actually thought I wasn't hurt. I disguised the hurt really well. So when he landed his best shot and I was still there in front of him, you know, fighting, I think he thought, I can't knock this guy out. And I think he realised then the fight was over. But he actually did catch me good. And getting back to the answer to your question was, Chris Eubank was a very tough fight, but Nigel Benn was a very dangerous fighter with an amazing power. And so if I was to have a rematch, you know, I'm someone who would you not fight rather than fight Nigel Benn over Chris Eubank, because I was sure that punching power was just frightening.
And as I say, Steve, you've been very kind of humble in describing your own skill set. But in what was a halcyon period, a golden era of British super middleweights, you hold victories over them all. You deserve your place in the boxing pantheon of all-time greats, accordingly. I guess my final question, when it pertains to your career, great as it is, was there, or is there now, whether you look back in retrospect, still that sense of frustration that a man you hunted, the pound-for-pound king at the time, Roy Jones Jr., who was fighting at the time at light heavy, just eluded you? Again, the boxing politics, etc., etc. Is there a sense, looking back, that that would have been one for the memory, one for the night, and maybe the super of all super fights? Again, is there that sense of frustration now, or have you just made peace with your wonderful career as it stands?
Well, there's two questions there. I'll try and answer both. Well, at the time, the top middleweight was not Chris Eubank and Brian Jones. You know, I got the Chris Eubank fight, I got the Nigel Benn fight, and I wanted to rise John's fight. You know, to me, the only big belt out there for me, there was nobody else. There was great up and coming fighters, but they weren't known, you know, to the world audience. They were up and coming. So the last big name for me that I wanted and was Roy Jones, and I done everything in my power to make that fight happen, and it just never happened because I know my heart and soul, and Roy Jones is a personal friend of mine. I like him. He won't admit to it, but he knows that I had a style that would give him problems, because I boxed in America most of my career. He knew all about me. He knew of me, and we fought opponents. We shared opponents as well. So that was the one fight I wanted. I'm probably lucky I didn't get it. He probably would have given me, you know, a proper beating. I don't know, but I would have liked to find out, you know, how great he was. I believe there's a way to beat him, and there's a way to beat everybody. And I saw what I believe are weaknesses in him, and I thought I could expose his weaknesses, and with the right plan, I reckon I could beat him. But it never happened, and I pushed hard for it. It never happened, but I'm fine. You know, I'm fine right now because I'm in a great place now. I'm very happy now. So whatever led me to where I am now, whatever happened in the past led me to where I am now. So I've no complaints, and I'm very content.
Yeah, Steve, look, I can't fault you at all. Like I say, I mean, one of the all-time greats. Objectively speaking, I must say, as a fight fan, it's one of those that I do feel the fight world was deprived of. And far be it for me to disparage or, you know, have a pop at Roy Jones, I do feel as though perhaps that you would have been a fight where he had more to lose fighting you in every sense of the word than he might have gained. And I find that a little bit, again, just purely and simply as a fan of the great sport of boxing, one of those that we would have loved it. That would have been an amazing one, no questions.
He should have taken the fight. He should have made it happen, because, you know, it was established in America, and I came back to Britain and I fought the big names in the world who brought British fighters, and I was ready to return from America to fight him. And there were the two big names at our time before the up and coming guys came behind us, you know, and it should have happened. And I went to him, I sat with him, I sat with his managers. They didn't want it, and it wasn't going to happen. And at that point then, when that was confirmed to me, I had absolutely no more interest in the sport. And I woke up one morning and I just thought, you know what, I have no interest in this game. I've achieved a lot of great things. I've got a great family. I'm very happy. I'm healthy. And I've got all my own plans and my personal life that I've put on hold for 20 years that I want to do. So I thought, there's no incentive now for me to fight. There's no desire, no drive, and nothing else to achieve. So it's time to get out of the game when you haven't got that hunger. And I no longer had the hunger when Roy Jones confirmed he was going to fight me.
Perfectly phrased. And again, so many in the wonderful world of boxing, alas, haven't had the wherewithal to come to that decision, carry on far too long, tarnish legacies, etc., etc. Just really quickly want to get your thoughts ahead of a massive, massive fight just a few hours away now in Vegas. Tyson Fury, Wilder 2, one that is really getting the boxing world kind of salivating. You talked about Nigel Benn's punching power. Goodness me, the bomber, Wilder really has that. Fury, of course, took his greatest shot and miraculously, it seemed, came off the canvas. For me and many, many people's pennies, Fury still should have won that last fight on points. It's in Vegas. Does Fury have to do the business with a KO to prevent certain nefarious judging? Or do you think, like I say, it's open. It's a fascinating fight. Your thoughts ahead of the big one on the early hours of Sunday morning?
Well, first of all, how exciting, how great it is to see a heavyweight title fight of two fighters. And you can't pick a winner. They're both great fighters. I mean, heavyweight boxing is exciting because this fight's coming off. And I'm of the opinion, and Fury won the last fight when, and the politics and the rubber in the game and not fighting at home, he didn't get the decision. To me, he won it. So that's history now. He's obviously got a rematch. But Wilder, to me, I guess what's going through Fury's mind is probably what was going through my mind fighting Nigel Benn. He knows he could be winning this fight. He could be outboxing this guy. He could be, you know, outpunching him. You know, there could be a half minute to go in the last round, and Wilder lands. That's it. It's lights out, because Wilder is one of the most devastating punches of all time. And for the, you know, up until the last second of the last round, he could knock anybody out.
I mean, goodness me, in his last fight against Ortiz, he was getting absolutely schooled through five, six, seven, eight rounds. Then, boom, out of nowhere. It is freakish. It's truly deadly, the force he possesses.
It's almost unnatural. And he's got this, you know, he's so lean and he whips the man. He's got sickening power. And he's a guy that, you know, he could be, as I said, Fury could have been every round. It's not until the final bell rings and he's still on his feet when you know he'll get a chance to win. But the power of that man is just, it's frightening. It's frightening. I mean, I think he's probably not as devastating as Tyson, because Tyson's a combination puncher and so on. But to me, as a single puncher, he's definitely a better puncher than Mike Tyson.
His record speaks for itself accordingly, doesn't it? Yeah. I mean, goodness me.
Yeah, it's frightening. And it's great. It's not very often looked forward to big world title, heavyweight title fights, but this is what I'm looking forward to. And I really, really hope Tyson Fury wins. Number one, I hope he wins to bring some title back to Britain. And number two is, he's a character and he's a personality, and I think he's good for the game. And, you know, the more we see of him, the more we fall in love with him, the more we like him. I think he's a true character. I think he's only good for boxing. And I'd love to see him bring the title back to the UK. And then maybe they could have the tour fight, probably, I don't know, Wembley. But I don't think it'll happen in Wembley. I think it'll happen over in the United Emirates somewhere, or back in Vegas. That's where the money is. But I'd like to see Fury win anyway, regardless of the way he would defend it in a rematch.
I tell you what, it is fascinating stuff. Final question on the Fury fight. You know, Ken, you understand the game inside and out. Your thoughts on his split with his trainer, Ben Davison, that got him through that bout of depression, that return to the ring, a miraculous, it seemed to us, kind of regime of fitness. To go to, again, he's boxing royalty, Javon Sugar Hill, nephew, of course, of Emmanuel Stewart. But again, I don't know. I'm not sure. What do you think, if at all, that change of coach will have an impact on this massive fight?
Well, the coach he has now is a more experienced and been around a lot longer than Ben Davis, so he's a more knowledgeable coach. He knows that Ben Davis has taught him. Now he's going to go to a new coach and learn more. I had probably five of the best coaches in the world in my professional career, and every one I moved on from, I brought with him and took with me what I learned from him. And the next coach I came to, I learned more from him. You know, the more coaching you get, the more different angles you get, the more you learn. My first coach was Guido Petronelli, who brought Marvin Hagler to the world title. My next coach after that was Floyd Patterson, former heavyweight champion of the world. I learned so much from Petronelli. I learned so much from Floyd Patterson. My next coach after that was Oscar Checa, a great Panamanian fighter. I learned so much from him. And then, you know, I went on to Freddie King, who had three or four world champions from London, and I learned so much from him. And then I finished up with my old friend Freddie Roach, another great trainer. So I had great five different coaches, five different trainers in my professional boxing career, and each one of them taught me something different and something more. And, you know, I was better every time I moved on to the next one. So, you know, Tyson Fury, he's got the knowledge he learned from his previous coach, and he's going to add that to what he learns from his new coach. A man can only teach you what he knows. You understand? So, and there's so much out there to learn, and there's so many people out there to learn from, that if you're going to stick to the one coach throughout your career, that's great. Be loyal to that coach. But that coach has got to take you to be with other fighters and other coaches to learn from them as well. Because the man can only tell you what he knows. There's a lot more out there from, you can learn from different people. And I've learned from Gubby Petronelli about, you know, how to relax in the ring, how to control the ring. I learned from Floyd Patterson how to, you know, I learned power from him. I learned from Oscar Checa how to box inside with the great South Americans still. I learned from Freddie Roach, you know, how to cut a ring off. And then I learned from Freddie King how to cut a ring off. And then from Freddie Roach, my old friend in Boston, I learned how to put all those different things I learned together. So I think he's going to be a better fighter having moved on, because he's bringing with him the knowledge he learned, and he's going to add to knowledge from someone else, which is going to make him a wiser and better guy. So, you know, that's my opinion.
Steve, honestly, I really appreciate your kind of insights there. What a fascinating life as well you've lived. Again, that wonderful career. Then, you know, you pop up in Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels. Little cameo with a small Irish band, U2, the Sweetest Thing video. But I believe you're still kind of involved, at least with boxing, from a kind of training perspective at the moment. Just briefly, and in closing, just tell us a bit about what kind of gets the juices flowing these days, Steve.
I love the game of boxing, and professional boxing to me, you know, it's a very hard sport to get involved in. We're good as a coach, a manager, fighters, and the politics, and I don't really, to me, it's not for me. I love the raw amateur game, and I actually coach boxing, amateur boxing in the army, and the reason I do that is because it's so basic and so honest, and it's so competitive. And the guys and the kids that do it are just the best kids in the world. And so I stand up. That's my involvement in boxing now is coaching army boxing. And that's where I do most of my time, spend most of my time doing it. And I absolutely love it. And there's no politics involved. And there's guys from all levels, all backgrounds. And they're young kids and they're so fit. They just want to fight. They want to learn. They want to give it their best shot. And there's no politics involved because it's controlled by the army and the military. So it's very upfront and very straight and very honest, and I love it, you know. That's what I'm enjoying. That's my enjoyment in the boxing part of my life at the moment.
Steve, I tell you what, that's absolutely brilliantly concluded. I think a whole world could learn a thing or two about that purity and that honesty, taking away elements of politics and just the sheer enthusiasm and love of a great sport. Steve, honestly, what a great, great chat this has been for me. Real pleasure to enjoy your company. I'll let you go. Enjoy the fight, Fury Wilder. Here's hoping it's a good one. And I wish you every continued joy and happiness. Thanks
no
again.
Problem. No, thank you. And by the way, I fell into St. Albans 20 years ago by pure chance. And it was the best move I've ever made in my life. And I'm so happy here. It's a wonderful place. And obviously, my wife is from the area. So I've been in St. Albans now 20 years.
A mighty city of St. Albans, and we are honoured to have you as a resident, Steve.
I'm honoured to be here, and it's a great city, and I'm very lucky to live here. And anybody who lives here, you know, some people don't realise how lucky we are and what great the city is. I know it's a small city, it's like a town to me, but St. Albans City is a great place to live, and I'm very happy here.
Honestly, that's a superb end to a superb interview. Have a great rest of your weekend. Appreciate your time.
No problem. Thank you. All the best.